In recent years, there has been a significant rise in climate litigation worldwide, as claimants seek to hold both governments and corporate actors to account for how their actions, or inaction, are contributing to the climate crisis. Cases have focused on a variety of human rights concerns, and areas including energy transition, emissions reductions, and protecting biodiversity. In this podcast, IBA Global Insight assesses the trends in climate litigation and looks at its potential long-term impact. In 2019, in a landmark decision in the Ohende Foundation's case against the Netherlands, the country's Supreme Court found in favour of the environmental group that the state had a legal duty of care based on international human rights principles to reduce greenhouse gases to 25% below 1990 levels. Lucy Maxwell is co-director of the Climate Litigation Network, a project by the Ohende Foundation. She describes the key climate litigation trends we are witnessing.
One of the big trends is the use of human rights arguments in cases against states and increasingly against companies. Some of these cases are like the Urgenda case, and so for about 7 years we've seen those kinds of cases, which say that the state's failure to take greater climate action is a violation of its obligations to protect human rights of those within its jurisdiction. So that's one group that we've been seeing for a while now. But other human rights-based cases are growing. And we've seen there's about 100 rights-based climate cases, and more than a quarter of them have been filed since 2020. So there's really an increased use of that as a legal tool to hold states accountable. And the other ways in which human rights arguments are being used are in project-based cases. So in the extension of coal mines or infrastructure that has greenhouse gas implications, so airport extensions and those kinds of things. And communities are using human rights in a number of ways, both procedural human rights, so failure to give adequate consultation or access to information or fair hearing, as well as substantive human rights, so that a particular project, because of its contribution to climate change, will similarly affect the human rights of those within the state's jurisdiction. And finally, a new area of rights-based litigation is being called just transition climate litigation. And that's where communities who are being affected by infrastructure that states are adopting to reduce their emissions, wind farms, other kinds of technology, and they have found that they've not been consulted, their land's being used or taken over. And they're not necessarily opposed to climate action, but it needs to be done in a way that respects and protects the human rights of all people within the state. And so that's a new category of claims we're seeing. Another trend in climate litigation is scrutiny of states and companies' net zero targets. In the last year, we've seen claims against companies, one in Australia, one in France, on the basis of consumer law, indicating that the company is not substantiating its claims that it has a plan for net zero when you see what its expansion of its fossil fuel, you know, technology that hasn't yet been adopted, and there's a need to really to scrutinize them carefully. The final trend we're seeing is the persistent legal challenges to states' expansion of fossil fuels. We see in Australia numerous challenges to the continued expansion of coal mines, of gas. In the US, similarly, offshore gas licenses, in Argentina the same, in the UK, in the North Sea. And these cases have been run for 10 years or more. But what we now have is very clear scientific evidence about the tiny remaining carbon budget for a 1.5 degree world, and the fact that there is no room for additional new fossil fuel exploration. And the International Energy Agency was crystal clear on that last year. So these cases are now having an expanded scientific body of evidence to draw upon, and they will continue to turn to the courts to prevent this kind of expansion, which is contrary to scientific evidence.
David Barnden, principal lawyer at Equity Generation Lawyers, acted on behalf of a group of 8 students who in 2020 challenged the right of the then Australian Minister for the Environment to approve a coal mine extension project in New South Wales in the Sharma case. Here, Barnden describes the case and why he feels that despite the outcome in favour of the minister, the case may yet leave a positive legacy for future claims. The IBA's requests for comment from the office of the minister in question at the time of the case, Susan Lee, did not receive a response.
And the challenge was brought upon the basis that she had a duty of care in common law to avoid harming children, and those harms would arise from the emissions that would come from burning of coal from that particular coal mine. So the case was brought in September of 2020. It made its way through the federal court before a single judge. In May of 2021, a decision was brought down that established the minister did have a duty of care to avoid harming children when deciding upon whether or not to approve coal mines. That was a significant step change in the law, not just in Australia, but it's fair to say that it was the first decision in a common law country which established person in power had a duty of care to avoid harming today's children from the future impacts of climate change. So it was really quite momentous. The judgment was very powerful. It suggested that the inaction of today's adults was perhaps the greatest intergenerational injustice that had ever been seen. The minister, perhaps unsurprisingly, appealed that decision, and the point of appeal was on the existence of a duty. The first instance decision did not go so far as to grant an injunction to the children to prevent the minister from making a decision on the mine. And the reason was that the judge said, look, now that the minister has this information, has all this evidence on the harms of climate change, she should go off and think about it. And there was not sufficient evidence before the primary judge to say that the minister was likely to approve the mine. In any event, the existence of the duty was appealed, and recently the full court of the Federal Court of Australia brought down a unanimous decision on behalf of three judges that said that duty did not in fact exist, and there were a number of reasons for that. The children, who are our clients, have decided not to appeal further to the High Court, and so there the case rests. Our clients are students, you know, they're very young, and they've achieved a lot. You know, I don't think people can underestimate what they've achieved with this case, simply by virtue of exposing the fact in the public domain that the minister and the government do not have a duty at law to avoid harming children. This is really powerful, and I think it was really shocking to many people, especially people who aren't lawyers, and simply assume that the government would act to not harm children in any way, to act in a way that is reasonable to do so. Given the public pause for thought, I think, about how these decisions are made and who in fact benefits from them. It certainly puts climate science front and centre in the federal court and would make it very difficult to go back on that. So that's a major achievement. I mean, we look at the evidence that was brought in the Sharma case, and we look at how it was accepted by the court, and we use it as we investigate other cases on behalf of other clients. It's extraordinarily powerful. It really provides a platform for future cases.
Jessica Wentz, non-resident senior fellow at the Sabin Centre for Climate Change Law, assesses the potential impact of climate litigation in the longer term.
With the cases involving government defendants and government policies, we have had some really notable victories in the past few years. We have decisions from France and the Netherlands and Colombia and Germany as well, all holding that governments have obligations to either control greenhouse gas emissions at specific levels or avoid undertaking activities like deforestation in order to protect the health and well-being and fundamental rights of their citizens against climate change-related harms. And so those initial victories have paved the way for more lawsuits pursuing similar theories, and there are reasonable prospects of success for that litigation, absolutely. And I think really it's sort of contributing to the development of legal norms around government obligations and human rights and climate change that can affect government policy even in the absence of a specific lawsuit or a court order in terms of how governments are starting to understand what are their human rights obligations. In Germany and France and the Netherlands, we've had these court orders requiring governments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in order to protect human rights. And these decisions are very important in terms of their direct impacts on policy within those respective jurisdictions. And especially given that the more that we reduce emissions now, the less difficult this task is going to be going forward. There is information about this in the IPCC report, how it makes a big difference, the timing of those emissions reductions, and the faster they happen, the better. It makes limiting global warming to 2 or 1.5 degrees much more feasible if we get on it now. And so certainly those types of decisions have very direct impacts on government policies within their respective jurisdictions. And I would also say it's not just government conduct that's affected. It's all of the different private entities that are regulated by governments that are also affected. So there are these pass-through implications for corporate actors as well. I do think that this type of litigation also has sort of impacts that go beyond the effect of any individual court decision. Certainly, I think it contributes to sort of broader social discussions about responsibility for climate change. I mean, we've been having discussions about responsibility for climate change for a long time now, many decades, you know, throughout the course of UNFCCC negotiations. But I think that the litigation helps sort of bring a bit more clarity and detail to what it is that we mean when we talk about obligations related to climate change mitigation, for example. And sometimes these will be expressed as legal obligations in a court decision, but these also can be thought of as almost like social obligations where the court of public opinion will hold governments accountable for controlling greenhouse gas emissions. And so I do think that the litigation has an important impact outside of just the judicial victories themselves.